We're here today with Jagdish Bhagwati, who is a university professor at Columbia University and senior fellow in international economics at the Council on Foreign Relations. Professor Bhagwati, thank you very much for joining the Global Observatory today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Professor Bhagwati, is the current international aid and development framework fit for the 21st century? What kind of structural changes do you think are needed to adapt collective systems of delivering development to today's changed geopolitical realities?
I think what has changed is not just the rise of the emerging powers, which everybody mentions. So it's true that India and China, for instance, are giving aid. But it's not anywhere of the order that the Western countries have been doing traditionally. the one difference, of course, is that China doesn't go by any rules. India tends to go by it, but it's just not a big deal. So I think in many cases, the people who are, you know, worried about aid flows or concerned about increasing them, they always point to, and the civil society groups always point to, how China is spoiling the market for conditionality. And I think there is something to it. On the other hand, I do feel that, you know, well, much of our leadership, particularly on the executive side, would like to give aid because they're good-hearted people and want to have a change. Ultimately, in a pluralistic society like ours, where there are a whole lot of congressmen who are reflecting constituency interests, which often become lobbying interests of one kind or another, there it seems to me that it's good to open up some competition on the part of receiving countries. And ultimately, what is China doing, which is really that heinous, right? And so I'm in favor of, you know, lecturing to the Chinese, saying you should do better in terms of imposing some conditionality, but at the same time, not to spend too much time worrying about it. that in fact, the competition will generally be a good thing for the recipient countries. Otherwise, they get locked into all kinds of things which the president and good people like you and me may disapprove of.
Beyond the institutional framework, what's your take on current international development policies? From your point of view, do you believe the international community is largely getting it right in how it supports economic development in the world?
That's where I have a real problem, in the sense that I think the way we got into development thinking in the last maybe about 15 years ago was that somehow all these reforms which are aimed at opening up the markets and moving systems away from what I call anti-market fundamentalism, because people like Joe Stiglitz and George Soros always accuse people who are in favor of reforms of being market fundamentalists. So I often say, you know, they're using the M word for market, like the guys on the other side use the L word for liberals. And they're both equal figments of the imagination, you know. Certainly the M word is. And one of my friends, the Swedish trade minister, who's actually a socialist, he's a very good friend. And he said he came to Colombia and Soros and Stiglitz accused him of being a market fundamentalist. He almost lost his sleep over it. But it's just become an epithet of abuse. So I think the general ethos was that here were people beginning to move away from the old model where almost everything was controlled. And I used to say that one of the problems in many of these countries, including mine, India, was that Adam Smith's invisible hand was nowhere to be seen. I mean, literally, everything was being controlled. I mean, Kafka's, you know, maze of control was actually an understatement. Everything you could lay your hands on was control. So we were moving away from that. And then we had, therefore, a remarkable results as a result, because suddenly economies which had been unwittingly patterned on the Soviet model of extensive intervention were suddenly being liberated to be able to take certain decisions. Now, unfortunately, the UNDP fell under the sway of people like Mahbub Haq, who thought that the way to, that all these old models where we were talking about growth were wrong. what they didn't realize was that growth was an instrumental variable, as we put it in economics. It was not the objective of policy. It was an instrument from which we attained, if we just went through all the plans, including in Pakistan, where he came from. They always had a variety of objectives, healthcare, education, all of it for the poor, nutrition, better nutrition, all sorts of things. And so that was, he mistook it, I mean, or either misread it or what, but he said we had put GNP on a pedestal as a goddess. Now, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, I couldn't recognize any country in South Asia, and you know, which was doing that. And so I think the UNDP, because it was under the influence of people like Huck and Amartya Sen and so on, who were actually bringing the Indian ideas from the 50s and 60s about doing all of these things and presenting it to you guys here in the UNDP and saying, wow, see, this is what we development should be about, and misrepresenting everything. So I think they wound up locking UNDP into a set of attitudes, which then, you know, made out like growth was no good. And then Mahbub Haq had also some influence with McNamara, but particularly later on when Jim Wolfensohn came in. Jim Wolfensohn, again, was a banker. And he had gotten the job largely because he was running the Clinton's estate, I think. And so he had good connections. And so he got the job. And, you know, he knew something about the equity markets and so on. So he fit into that mold. And then what he got into was, he was then looking for something on development, which he knew nothing about. And then he brought in Professor Sen and Professor Stiglitz as his advisors. And they were all anti-growth. And so that's how Wolfensohn got locked into it, you see. And from there it spread. So that and the UNDP. So it was a series of tragic coincidences which led to crowning of anti-reforms, anti-growth as the great big message to the world. Now it's changed because nothing works like success. And now today people realize that growth has been inclusive, because once you grow rapidly like China and India did, I mean, they were supposed to be giants which were supposed to wake up, right? But they continued snoring until the reforms arrived. Then they took off like a rocket, you see, both of them. India at about, you know, an average of 8 to 9% instead of 3.5%. And China even faster. And that pulled lots of people into employment. Because I think it's, again, common sense, right? I mean, that if you're a stagnant economy, you're not going to have much of an impact. I mean, a rapidly growing one may not have much of it, but it's highly unlikely that it would actually harm you. So I think that's what worked out. Poverty decline, and actually now know from a lot of research, at least in India, that the backward classes, the untouchables, the tribals, all of them shared. They were not completely isolated at all. The notion that tribals are completely removed from the mainstream economy is just not correct. And so I think what you have, therefore, is a situation where a lot of people prospered as a result of this. What you can say is that while, therefore, in that sense, growth was inclusive, by which you mean it went down and brought people up out above the poverty line, which I must tell you is still nothing very much to write home about, because they're still poor, just above the poverty line. So we have to intensify that. So I think now there's a lot of interest in the system. And I think one of the things about the democracy helps also, because in a democratic system, you get agitation, but you also get response. It takes a little while, but you know, then government set up committees, people look into these things, and so on. So I think that is what's been happening in India. Unlike in China, where you don't have any institutions of a liberal democracy, and therefore all you can do is bang on pots and pans, cause what is called social disruptions, and now they're picking up on the internet and so on, but they still have long ways to go, and China could implode, but we will never implode, because we've never. And in fact, it was our size which made a difference. I remember when I was a young, student, about 19, and they wanted to to, I mean, there was a Bombay presidency, and all the states were being reorganized. So there was one called Maharashtra, and there was another called Gujarat, where I and the great Gandhi come from. I always throw that in just to make me sound more impressive. But that is where people are mainly entrepreneurial. And like even Gandhi was a practical saint. I mean, he literally didn't. I think he would have not starved him literally to death, because he probably knew he would be saved on the 54th day or something. But I'm just joking a little bit. But he was really a very powerful and saintly figure. And then, but the Maharashtrians had actually provided the labor, and the Gujaratis had provided the capital. So the question was, you know, whom should the city go to? And Nehru decided it should be like Washington, D.C., or New Delhi, just a, you know, city, state by itself. Hundreds of thousands of people poured out on the Maharashtrian side. I remember that. And on the first day, the police fired like in the old British days. Crowds just got larger, and Nehru realized that there was no way you could have anything except democracy. He just gave away the city to the Maharashtrians. So I think I would say that the politics of democracy and the good economics, meaning reform-oriented economics, of assault on poverty are a strong combination. And that's what India has had, politics and economics, right? And you actually, if you read the Prime Minister Nehru's speech in 47 on India's Tryst with Destiny, he actually brings out both. I mean, and that's going to be the title of our book coming out in October, which is, we have to have democracy for politics, and then we've got to have, in fact, he says rapid growth. That's common sense, as I told you. We're going to have rapid growth before we can impact on poverty. And then, in fact, affecting poverty was the first job I had when I went back to India in the Planning Commission from 1961 to 63. So we've been, you know, involved in that. So what I would like the UNDP, which really got captured by the wrong set of people. I know the New Zealand Prime Minister who is running the UNDP now, but I don't think she's a background for this sort of thing at all, because a lot of people come from being prime ministers and so on, and then they get into this job. And then they've got this existing secretariat, you know, which has already nursed itself on all the wrong ideas. It's very difficult. So you have to have somebody at the top who really has thought about the problem, right, and has read things and discussed things. So it's very difficult, because you hit the ground running. I mean, World Bank could play a good role too, but World Bank, as I said, starting with Wolfensohn, did not. And Dr. Kim is a good doctor by all accounts and has done good work on AIDS and so on. But those are, but he doesn't know anything about development and about growth and how that actually helps you transform economies, generate revenues which people can use. If I was in a job like that, I would have to also, people would ask me, do I have the judgment to select good staff who will actually advise me properly? That's the most difficult thing, because, I mean, you're as good or as bad as your advisors in many of these, with the multiple things going on and multiple things to look at and so on.
Going back to your model of economic growth first and coupled with building political institutions, if you take that as the Indian success story, given your concerns about Dr. Kim, what would your advice be for him and for the World Bank, and what their top priorities should be going forward over the next decade?
I think the World Bank basically today is not a big donor agency, as we all know. I mean, it's not it's not what it used to be. You have to take the International Finance Corporation out. So today, I think the general idea is that it should be a knowledge bank. But knowledge means you disseminate knowledge, but you have to have the knowledge first, and then the right kind of knowledge. I think the first thing I would advise him, if I was Tim Geithner, the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, who basically gave him the job, I think, is to say, look, set yourself up with a number of really first-rate advisors who are not just conventional development economists, who are willing to look at what has actually happened in the world in terms of the kinds of things you were against in like 2000 when you came out, and see and learn for yourself how good, you know, so many of these reforms are, how inclusive they've been, and how they interact very nicely with politics of democracy, and how we can strengthen the democratic institutions and so on. Not that he's going to do it, but, you know, there are other agencies to do it. That is really what he needs. I think he doesn't really need anything on healthcare, except that the kinds of problems we have on healthcare also are somewhat different from the ones which that you have on AIDS, etc. A lot of people are spending money now, not even going to the public hospitals where the doctors are supposed to be better, but they don't turn up, nurses don't turn up, absenteeism is rampant. So they go to private clinics, which are not that good, I mean the doctors, but at least they turn up for a fee. And the fees are quite modest, actually. And same thing is happening in education and so on. So he's now got to be able to say, look, we are in a different ball game, even on education, health, etc. It's not no longer the big diseases on which you made your reputation, right? That is where also you need a very appropriate task forces or people, advisors who are really have a range of, you know, talent. That's all. So I think we can work at it, but the World Bank, at least in many developing countries, still remains an important influence, much more than UNDP. UNDP is kind of sporadic. And they don't have, and the World Bank has actually good staff. The young people are very good. And the UNDP, I mean, I'm a great supporter of UN from the earliest days, but I've noticed a certain decline in the quality of, I mean, very few people now tell their students to go and work for UN, unless they're desperate for a job. The leaders have to be open to new ideas, because economics is not like rocket science in the sense that it's a social science. You have to learn, you know, with the experience and so on. You may learn the wrong things sometimes, but you have to learn. You have to keep an open mind. Now, someday I may be a protectionist, who knows? God forbid. But I have to look at the arguments against freer trade. I can't just stay put in my own belief. So I think we need leadership. We need continuous feedback from the evolving experience. And unfortunately, both in the bank and more so in UNDP, the ideas about development are really, unwittingly calculated to harm the developing countries. So I think this really needs to be taken in hand. And I hope that, some of these messages get through. But I think in that sense, the World Bank and UNDP, which are the two main agencies, and then there are the OECD and the UNCTAD, which are the think tanks of the rich and the poor countries, respectively. They all need really leaders who will surmount their secretariats in a way, because secretariats tend to be behind the curve, as I pointed out, and really take a sharp look at where we are at now, to provide the leadership, I feel. And then they will attract first-rate students. There's so many economists coming out. At Columbia, it's the most popular discipline, the largest one, about 300 students. And so, because everybody wants to do some economics. So I think there's a huge supply of them.
Dr. Bhagwati, thank you so much for this interview.